Thursday, August 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russia discusses the possibility of lengthening the humanitarian pause in Aleppo. A South African military historian boasts a huge war collection. And the music group Lady Antebellum is singled out for its charitable contributions. It's all ahead. UN officials say Russia is willing to discuss the lengthening of its three-hour daily suspension of military action in the besieged Syrian city of Aleppo. The officials are also investigating reports that a bomb containing chlorine gas was used by the Syrian military in the area. The Russian military was set to begin Thursday a daily temporary pause in hostilities from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. local time in order to allow humanitarian aid workers to bring in much-needed supplies. But Mohammed Rashid, a spokesman for one of the rebel groups fighting the Syrian government, told Reuters the Thursday ceasefire had not been upheld. Instead, he said there had been an escalation in Russian warplanes and government forces had tried to advance on the Ramusha district of Aleppo. A witness in Aleppo and another rebel official corroborated Rashid's claims, according to Reuters. The initial temporary ceasefire announcement was welcomed by U.S. State Department spokeswoman Elizabeth Trudeau.
We would welcome any pause that successfully facilitates delivery of vitally needed humanitarian supplies, but such a ceasefire must be observed by all parties. Our position has not changed. There are commitments that mandate free and open access for delivery of supplies requested by the UN. All parties must abide by those commitments. All supplies, including food and medical supplies, as determined and requested solely by the UN, need to be delivered now. Any pause in the violence is good for the people of Syria. You know, I'd also, though, point out what we've said all along, that we continue to call for a nationwide, permanent cessation of hostilities. You know, further cooperation with the Russians will require some bottom lines. That includes restraint on the part of the regime, which so far hasn't been forthcoming. You know, I'm not going to get ahead of any announcement. We believe that space for a permanent ceasefire does permit the sort of political talks that need to happen for a transition.
UN humanitarian chief Stephen O'Brien warned that 2 million people are without access to electricity or fresh water. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales in Australia tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he believes a UN proposal of 48 hours is more realistic if humanitarian concerns are really paramount.
It seems to me that it must fit into some sort of response to difficulties that the Syrians and the Russians have been having around Aleppo over the last couple of days, where the siege, the blockade has been broken, and at the same time, the government-controlled area of Aleppo is in itself risking being isolated. And so I think they're probably trying somehow or other to slow down rebel advances, to give the Assad government time to get forces into position, etc. But in terms of providing substantial aid to, well, we're talking 2 million people, they're not going to achieve anything with those short breaks.
We have a French press agency report that indicates that in rebel districts where an offensive has broken a government siege for the first time in nearly a month, markets in opposition-held districts of Aleppo are bustling with eager shoppers snatching up vegetables, chicken, and even cigarettes. Obviously, there is some aid getting in.
This is the most extraordinary thing about this conflict. I've been in Turkey where I encountered Christian Syrians whose job it was to cross the border into Turkey, trading stuff and then taking it back and crossing lines, fighting lines into one side or other of the conflict. It's porous to a point. There is stuff getting through. There is trade going on. People are producing stuff, but it's very limited. The capacity for people to get adequate food and especially the health care is very limited.
There's an analysis piece on Reuters which says in breaking a Syrian government siege on opposition areas of Aleppo, insurgents have set back President Assad's hopes of using Russian air power to reclaim a vital city and speed the end of the five-year conflict. What do you think?
Yes, I think so. It's been a real problem for Assad. He was sounding quite confident, and as were the Russians, I think, that the blockade that they'd established was going to be the the end of it. And this would have been a very significant symbolic, but not just symbolic, achievement for the government. But instead, what they're faced with is the prospect that their own part of the city is going to be isolated and they're going to have to fight to regain access to it.
That's Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales in Australia. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, it seems like every day I come in here and there's something new that Donald Trump has said that has set social media off. And today is no different. Earlier today, Donald Trump saying that President Obama is the founder of ISIS, the terror organization, and that Hillary Clinton is a co-founder of the organization because of the policies that they put in place allowing that organization to form and succeed. Of course, this is not being well received by Hillary Clinton supporters and folks on the left of the political spectrum. They're saying these are inflammatory remarks, not fitting of somebody who is running for president, let alone wants to fill the Oval Office and sit in the White House. Trump supporters on social media are doubling down and say, if you look at the policies, they really did set up for this group to happen and succeed in Iraq. So there's a lot of back and forth. As we were just saying before we went on, we're going to have to do 80-some-odd more days of this, and gosh only knows what's coming down the pike. But social media really has been a vehicle for these moments, and I think one thing we've seen, certainly in this election, but as a trend, is that you see a lot more of these instances where the candidate says something and it gets, you know, such broad release and such wide coverage because of social media. It spreads kind of like wildfire.
Yeah.
The other thing that we have trending today, hashtag save Twitter. There was a rumor going around that Twitter was going to be shutting down in 2017. Apparently that is not the case, but it doesn't stop people from saying why they love Twitter and why it should be saved. I think it was a viral marketing campaign by Twitter to get some love from their fans, but we'll see.
Okay. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. Ukraine and Russia trade angry accusations as war fever mounts. Hillary Clinton unveils an economic plan while deriding Donald Trump's tax cut proposal. A key military command is accused of manipulating Islamic State intelligence, and the Hubble Space Telescope gets a new five-year contract. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's thought that the first telescopes emerged sometime in the 17th century. But is it possible that ancient stargazers could have studied the heavens with their own observation tools long before the modern telescope? Scientists are proposing to learn whether or not long, narrow passageways or prehistoric tombs were used as a way to enhance views of the night sky some 6,000 years ago. The scientists want to find out if the human eye might be able to see stars of any given brightness or color without the help of any telescopic device in locations such as the Seven Stone Antas in central Portugal. Those proposing this investigation say that ancient astronomers were able to better observe certain stars from deep within one of these passageways. Spotting a particular star may have provided a way to mark the seasons. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the genetic links of autism. South African military enthusiast Alan Coleman boasts one of the biggest private collections of war-related material in the world. From swords used in the Napoleonic Wars in Europe in the early 1800s to British machine guns used in the Second World War. Some of Coleman's pieces relate to Africa's many conflicts, from Zulu spears to bullets from the Mau Mau insurgency in 1950s colonial Kenya. For VOA, Darren Taylor takes us to Coleman's shop in Johannesburg.
Music from the Second World War era greets visitors to the war store in Rosebank, Johannesburg. The space is a kaleidoscope of battlefield uniforms, military badges, helmets belonging to dead tank commanders, and soldiers' torn, muddied love letters from World War I trenches. But Alan Coleman specializes in war material from Africa. He has deactivated rifles from South African troops who fought Cuban-supported Angolan forces in the late 1970s. Some of Coleman's rare footage, a Cuban fighter jet takes off to attack a South African base. Coleman holds a tattered, stained, light brown hat. It once belonged to a fighter for the Southwest Africa People's Organization, SWAPO. A South African infantryman shot him dead during an insurgency in what's now Namibia in the mid-1980s.
It's Russian-made, but then it was used by SWAPO. It's obviously been in combat because it's got a hole. We're not sure if this is blood or some sort of brain matter, possibly.
But not all of Coleman's items are from combat.
What we've got over here is from the Boer War. It's actually from the concentration camps where the South African Boers were put into camps by the British. This is an original doll that was made in the camps for the Boer children, and it's made out of material with a painted face.
The British fought the Boers in South Africa in the early 1900s. In the following song from the conflict, an Afrikaner band celebrates the legendary Boer general, Christiaan de Wet. Some of Coleman's favourite material was given to him by South Africans who fought with the legendary British mercenary Mad Mike Hoare in the mid-1960s to overthrow the Congolese government.
These items here are from that actual action. So we've got a bag here, and all the stuff in here was either captured flags and the guy's personal stuff. There's some photographs of him in the Congo, in his gear. So this sort of stuff is very well sought after because this is the real soldier of fortune stuff.
Through 66 and 7, they fought the Congo War.
The South African mercenaries were immortalized in Warren Zevon's classic song, Roland, the Headless Thompson Gunner, always on the War Stores playlist. People from all over the world bring Coleman war-related items.
They'll have it in their cupboards from their grandparents, from generations before. They don't know what it is, and then we assess it for them. We even had a guy that came in the one time with a Victoria Cross. He had it in his drawer from his grandfather from the Boer War. When I told him the value of it, he fell over backwards. We got him over R1 million for that item.
With money like this at play, Coleman's collection is protected by a sophisticated security system.
Yes, we've got everything. Everything that can possibly be used, we have it.
He sells to private collectors around the globe, but maintains his quest for the objects of conflict has another motive.
The important part here is getting the history out of the woodwork into the collector's hands. The collectors pay for it, so therefore they're going to look after it.
Coleman owns a lot of memorabilia from the Second World War, with Britain's Prime Minister at the time, Winston Churchill, a big presence in his shop.
The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization.
Coleman points to a grey uniform. On its collar, the black lightning bolts of Germany's infamous SS squad.
We've got Third Reich stuff, Nazi stuff here, and we get a lot of the Jewish clients coming to us and say, how can you sell this stuff? But the fact is, if we don't sell it and keep it alive, it's going to be forgotten. We have Jewish clients who actually buy the Nazi stuff to keep it alive so that people can remember.
Coleman says it's fascinating to interact with war veterans.
The other day we had a guy that was 96 years old. He served in World War II. He was up in North Africa, and then he went to Italy. Just speaking to the guys, they're living history. In 10 years' time, they're all going to be gone.
He says he sometimes gets unexpected visitors, including men who served with the German SS on the Russian front. They, like others, come to tell him their stories. Coleman travels the world almost non-stop in search of rare pieces for a collection he knows he'll never complete, and doesn't want to either. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Researchers have used a novel computer program to locate potential genetic candidates that could play a role in the development of autism. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Children with autism spectrum disorder have trouble communicating, learning, and socializing with the outside world. The condition runs the spectrum from mild awkwardness to complete social isolation. So far, 65 autism risk genes have been identified, but how they disrupt the brain's natural development is still unknown. Investigators think there could be anywhere from 400 to 1,000 autism genes altogether. Using what they call a machine learning computer program, researchers at Princeton University in the United States discovered 2,500 genes they believe could play a role in ASD. The new leads were published in the journal Nature Neuroscience. A researcher at Princeton's Lewis Sigler Institute for Integrative Genomics, Arjun Krishnan, says there are 25,000 genes in the human body. To narrow down the genes within the vast brain circuitry that may contribute to the development of ASD, investigators looked at the huge array of connections among genes responsible for brain function. Krishnan likened it to finding friends on Facebook.
Facebook wanted to find out who your friends are and wanted to suggest a friend for you. What they would do is to find out who your friends are and then find out other people who are friends with those same people. And if they are very likely friends with you too. So that's how they give suggestions of new friends that you might know. And we use a very, very similar strategy.
Krishnan says the machine learning program identified similarities between brain-related genes and the 65 autism risk genes, finding still other genes that are friends of both. Princeton University computer science and genomics professor Olga Troyanskaya says certain combinations of genes may explain why one child on the spectrum is mildly affected and another child is severely disabled.
A lot of evidence points to the fact that their entire set of what the rest of their genetics looks like likely has a very strong impact on what outcome that would have, both whether they would have autism and pretty much for sure what exact symptoms they would have.
There's no cure for what has become one of the most common developmental disorders to strike young children. But early intervention in the form of physical and behavioral therapies has been shown to be beneficial to youngsters with autism. Unfortunately, there's no diagnostic test beyond observation, but researchers are hoping their work could eventually lead to a way to diagnose very young children so they can be helped as soon as possible. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Country artists commonly use their celebrity to make a difference in the lives of others. Recently in Nashville, the organization Musicians on Call honored Lady Antebellum with the 2016 Music Heals Awards. Nikki Strong of VOA Music shares how this popular country music trio has been instrumental in helping countless patients and hospital facilities. So, Nikki, what is Musicians on Call?
Musicians on Call is a great nonprofit organization. It was founded in 1999, and it brings music to the bedsides of hospital patients all over the country. And Pete Griffin, who's the president of the organization, said that, you know, whenever they've needed help, Lady Antebellum is the first one to raise their hands. And so over the past 6 years, Lady Antebellum has supported them in fundraisers and performances, as well as hospital visits.
Well, this cause also really hits home for Lady Antebellum.
It does. Hillary Scott's late grandfather was in the hospital battling leukemia 5 years ago, and she says she really saw and experienced how music helped both him and her during treatment, especially when it came to getting through really difficult times.
Many other country artists support musicians on call as well.
Yes, Lindsay L. is a major volunteer for the organization as well. Hunter Hayes, Eric Pasley. But anyone can actually support the organization in a variety of ways. They can go to musiciansoncall.org.
Well, congratulations to Lady Antebellum for the 2016 Music Heals Award. You can hear Lady Antebellum's music on Country Hits with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also send your comments, requests, and questions to Nikki at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA_music on Twitter. Thanks very much, Nikki.
Anytime.
This world keeps spinning faster into a new disaster. So I run to you. I run to you, baby. When it all starts coming.
And that is the music of Lady Antebellum. As we come to the end of our show, please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Fulgence Kayeshima, a former police official in the Republic of Rwanda, is wanted for taking part in the Rwandan genocide in the early 1990s. In his capacity as inspector of the judicial police in Kivumu Commune, Mr. Kayeshima was one of the main instigators of killings there aimed at committing genocide. In April 1994, he helped organize and took part in an attack by his communal police on a church where refugees fleeing the violence had sought shelter. Some 2,000 people died in the attack. For these and other crimes, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the ICTR, indicted Mr. Kayeshima on charges of genocide and war crimes and issued a warrant for his arrest. The United States is cooperating with other governments, the United Nations and ICTR, to make it harder for Mr. Kayeshima and others sought for the killing to continue to elude justice. Toward that end, the U.S. has renewed an offer of a reward for up to $5 million for information leading to his arrest. Fulgence Kayeshima fled Rwanda and is believed to be living in the Southern African region. He is believed to be living in one of the countries in Southern Africa and travels a lot within the region. If you or anyone you know has information on his activities and whereabouts, it can be provided with complete confidentiality. You may contact the nearest U.S. Embassy, or you can call internationally, 243-81-715-2501, or by email at rewardsforjusticedrc@yahoo.com. or on the internet at www.rewardsforjustice.net/war crimes. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.